Welcome to Registry Matters. This is an independent production. Our opinions are our own. We're thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios, East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 374 of Registry Matters. What's up, Larry? How are you tonight?
Doing awesome. Glad you invited me back this week. Is this my last week?
It will be your last week if I can find someone else that's willing to do the grunt work that you do, which doesn't seem to be anybody. So you'll probably be back next week, too.
They're not lining up to do work?
They are probably lining up to not do the work and just participate, but they don't want to do the work.
That is really shocking to me.
I mean, how many people have stepped up to help me edit? Not that we've ever asked, but like, hey, I'll help you edit that if you want. No one has ever offered.
Well, they don't realize. They think it's all magic.
It kind of is magic. If all of a sudden you just hit the refresh button on your podcast app and the thing shows up, that kind of is magic. It is pretty magical what is happening. You know, we were talking this completely off script, but we were talking just the other day about the deregulation. I don't know what the right word is, from Reagan with the fair time thing. And then that created 24-hour news cycles. Prior to that, you and I would basically be watching the same news-ish, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC. We would have sort of a shared experience of what news was going on in the world. And now everyone is in their own little bubble. However, with that own little bubble is, we would never be able to get a platform for our many thousands of listeners. We would never be able to get a platform in that era. There would be no way for us to deliver anything to anybody.
That's absolutely correct. But that's not anything to be commending deregulation, I don't think. I think it's the proliferation of technology. Deregulation caused the concentration of ownership in media, which wasn't allowed previous to that. And it narrowed the focus of media because they grouped the radio and TV stations into these large conglomerates. And it all became pretty much focused on what upper management said on Wall Street.
Very true. Well, make sure you press like, subscribe, friend us, follow us, whatever you want to call it, on all of the different podcast apps. I have redesigned the Registry Matters website, so go check it out. I think it looks pretty awesome, if I may say so myself. And all of that. So what are we doing tonight?
Well, I did a lot of thoughtful contemplation. I had two things that had the civil commitment that we're going to do last week. And I had a case that I thought I was going to do about Florida, but it turns out the case was already 3 years old, so it was a little bit stale to do that.
Did you happen to challenge the person on why they sent you a three-year-old case?
No, but I think it was because we were trying to prove a point that no one gets prosecuted for the imaginary boogeyman if you overstay your limitation by an hour or two, and Florida has some of the strictest rules for registering for out-of-state visits, and people don't get prosecuted for that. And I try to explain logically why you don't get prosecuted for that. But it's futile to try to explain that because people believe they will be prosecuted. And in fact, somebody told me recently they were almost prosecuted, but I asked for details, and I didn't get any details.
So that would be like attempted prosecution as opposed to attempted murder or attempted kidnapping, anything like that?
Indeed. Well, the biggest thing that keeps you from being prosecuted, the two biggest things, is A, they don't know you're there unless you encounter law enforcement.
But suppose you tell them you're there.
Well, they would know then. But if you just don't tell them, they don't know you're there. But beyond that, they run the risk of you being stuck there. And I know it breaks people's heart to try to understand this, but if I'm a prosecutor in Broward County, Florida, and I have to get elected by my constituents in Broward County, and I've got a PFR from Montgomery, Alabama, that stayed 49 hours, and I lock that person up, and they're not able to make bond, I run the risk that they get stuck in my jurisdiction.
It's true.
Because they lose their job. If the PFR bond gets set really high, they lose their job, and then they're stuck. But then I have to hope I can give you a life sentence where you can never see the light of day again. If I can't do that, you may not go back to Alabama after you get out of my jail. And then I've got a person who might be PFRing in my county that wouldn't have been here. And then I have to run the risk of the camera rolling in and say, now let me make sure I've got this straight. You extradited this person down here from Alabama because they stayed 50 hours on a 48-hour limit. Is that correct? Yeah, we did that. And you prosecuted them. Yeah, we did that. And they served 7 years in prison at $50,000 a year. Yeah, we did that too. And they got out and committed a sex offense down here. And we would rather them be committing that in Alabama if they're going to commit it. Can you explain to the voters why you did that? That's a position.
Can you imagine the reporters actually doing it that way as opposed to, man, we got another one off the street. This guy had come from another state to do naughty acts here, and the streets are safer. Thank you, Sheriff. Isn't that how that conversation's actually going to go down?
Well, it could go down that way, particularly if it's in Polk County, where Sheriff Judd is. But there are a few objective reporters still left. I mean, we're pretty much on AI news generated by anything other than real reporting and investigation. But there's a chance that it might go the other way. And most people that are politically savvy are not going to bring someone to their jurisdiction that may be stuck there.
Interesting. So, all right, well then, continue on with what are we doing tonight?
We have this.
We got a little detour.
We have this deep dive on a case that's been underway for several years in Illinois about their civil commitment program. And also, we're going to respond to a listener comment or two about last week's episode. And that should just about wrap it up. I think two things will be enough, don't you?
Yeah. Did you actually receive some hate mail from last week's episode?
Well, I did receive a phone call. It wasn't really hate mail telling me that I'm crazy. So.
Isn't that actually just removed from the case we discussed? You're crazy regardless of the case we discussed?
So, yeah, I was called Mr. Doom and Gloom, and I was accused of being on the wrong side of the fight.
Now, that's pretty funny, actually. Explain why you felt and still feel this case was unnecessary and overly risky?
Sure. The reason why it was unnecessary was that the regulations that the AG had published, now remember, they had been published at the end of the Trump administration, number one. And when Biden came into office, Biden put the regulations on hold for further review because they hadn't taken effect. The requisite process hadn't run its course. And they were placed on hold. And then the Justice Department and Attorney General Garland's staff looked at it at the time. They said, looks pretty good to us. And they went ahead and finalized and published those regulations. Well, that's what they are. They're regulations. They're not law. And it's what the government would like to believe the law is, but unfortunately it is not. And what really got me was that there was no threat of prosecution for anyone who had been discharged from registration. And when I say discharged, this was a California-originated case. So California does have a petition process. So people that are discharged from registration have been granted removal by an order of a court. And nobody in California had been threatened with prosecution. But I think we've got, 47 states in the United States, right? 47?
I heard it was 57. Sorry.
Oh, 57. Okay. So 57. Okay. So in the remaining 56 states, there have not been any prosecutions threatened, and this case was filed in 2022. In those 56 remaining states, there have not been anybody threatened with prosecution. A lot of those 56 states do have removal processes, or they used to simply time off the registration obligation. Nobody had been threatened. It had never been implied that anybody was going to be prosecuted by prosecutorial entities, which would be United States Department of Justice or U.S. Assistant U.S. Attorney. Nobody has ever suggested they're going to prosecute anybody. So an injunction was issued in 2022 to prevent something from happening that wasn't on the horizon. Well, how do I know it wasn't going to happen? Because, Larry, you don't understand. There was an injunction issued. Yes, I do understand that. That injunction was valid in one of the 57 states. What about the other 56? If I were the U.S. government, I would have started prosecuting left and right in the other 56 states. They didn't. And that tells me that there was no credible threat of prosecution on the horizon. So that's the problem, that there was a non-existent problem. And I don't like using courts to solve problems that don't exist. But there's a political risk to this that the people that did this didn't take into account. Now that this published opinion is out there from a United States District Court judge in California, it could be taken up to the Ninth Circuit, too early to know. But the victim's advocate apparatus has access to this because it's a public document. And if I'm the victim's advocate apparatus, what I'm going to do is to use this as leverage on the California Assembly. I'm going to say, look, folks, this state is so lenient on sex offenders, and they allow all these thousands of people to fall through the cracks, and we've got this out-of-control, left-wing, lifetime tenured judge that made this asinine decision that since California won't register these people, that they're basically free to roam the countryside and do whatever they want to do. And that's going to put an enormous amount of pressure on the California Assembly to change the law so that it's easier to get these people back in registration status. If my fears come to fruition and the pressure builds, it's very hard to say, no, we ain't going to do that. It's all right that these people are off the radar and they've disappeared. That's a tough political position to sustain. And that's why I think it was too risky to do.
How can you be so sure that they didn't take those calculations into account when they filed it?
Well, I can't be certain that they did not, but I can be certain of this. Very few people have the political skills that I do to analyze what's likely to happen and think two or three steps down the road. And what their lawyers generally are about winning cases. And some lawyers are about winning cases that don't need to be won because it gives them notoriety and it keeps their name Yep. out there. But whether they considered this or not, I don't know. But I would like to think if you considered it seriously, you would tell the people this is a risk too great to take because we may create the very problem that we're trying to solve. We're trying to solve a non-existent problem, and we may create a law that says you have to register. And wouldn't that be funny if they did that?
No, not funny.
So,
because, you know, I mean, I'm off the registry, and it would be really annoying to me if someone came and said, you got to register. That would be really annoying.
So, well, that was my concern about this case, and I expressed it as best I could, and I didn't really have direct communication with the planning and execution of this lawsuit. They won a very, very narrow victory. They got shot down on 75% of their claims.
Right.
So
right.
That should tell you if they had carefully analyzed the veracity, that's not the right word, the merits and the strength of those claims. If you get knocked out on 3/4 of your claims, that tells me as an uneducated person that you didn't do a very good analysis. Most things, other than baseball, if you're only right about a quarter of the time, you don't make much money.
Yeah, except in baseball. That's correct. Yeah, wait a minute, baseball. If they do about 1/3, they freaking get paid monster amounts of money.
Yeah, if you can hit 270 to 300 in baseball, that if you get 25 to 30% of your at-bats connected with a hit, you're all right in baseball.
That is very true. Interesting. Well, I mean, the person did say something about you being doom and gloom, right? So that is how you have that title.
Well, I don't think I deserve that title. I think I'm the most optimistic person living.
Seriously? I hope you don't mean that.
I think you've got something to play for that, don't you?
Would this be the Looney Tunes? Is this the, which one is this? The laugh?
Yeah.
I'm done with that. All right. Well, shall we go over to civil commitment?
So I can make you laugh, can't I?
So, on a very rare occasion, when the moon and the planets are in alignment and whatnot. All right. Well, then in this case, it's about civil commitment. It was just decided, like, wow, that's just 2 weeks ago, on March 30th. And the name is Jacob Kalal. Is that what you got? Think that is?
I think so.
Okay. So Jacob Kalal and George Needs versus Salvador Godinez et al. Now, is this going to be a win for our side?
Yes, to a degree.
You always have to set aside some reservations about it. It can't just be yes, but no, you're like, eh, kind of. Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to set this up. The plaintiffs are civil detainees, which I'm assuming are people that are in civil commitment, classified as sexually dangerous persons, SDP. That's not an acronym we know of. So these are SVPs probably?
No, they have two different tracks in Illinois. These are SDPs.
Oh, so these are even different people. All right, well, then this is under the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act, so SDPA. The act permits the state to involuntarily commit and indefinitely confine individuals who have not been convicted of a crime, but who have been determined likely to commit acts of sexual violence in the future. Commit sexual acts of violence in the future?
Yes, that means that we lock people away for what they might do.
So I swear, Larry, so I've been like toying with this idea of doing this movie night with Larry about legal stuff. And one of the things that we have to watch is Minority Report. And this is exactly what this is. It's about thought crime. And they have these characters that are precogs and they predict that someone's going to commit a crime. And the police go out there and they go arrest the people before they've committed the crime. That's what this is.
I don't see any problem with it.
Okay, then. All right. So as you said in the opening, this case has been going on for years. Following a bench trial, the district court issued its finding of fact and conclusions of law. The district court also issued a permanent injunction requiring defendants, one, to provide plaintiffs a minimum of 7.5 hours of core group therapy per
week.
Each session per week. Okay. And then with each session lasting no less than 90 minutes. Number two, to reinstate all inactive offense-specific and didactic groups that were currently suspended, and three, requiring the use of independent evaluators other than Wexford Health for performing discharge evaluations. The defendants appealed. It would have gone to the Seventh Circuit, however, but what did they do?
Well, they appealed, of course, and on appeal, the Seventh Circuit noted by providing inadequate treatment, and as a result, depriving detainees of a realistic possibility of release, Illinois has failed to uphold its end of the balance. And the case from Seventh Circuit is cited as Howell versus Hughes, 74 Federal 4th at 849-859. And it was decided in 2023. The Seventh Circuit concluded the injunction was overbroad, the one that had been issued by the trial judge, and remanded the case back for the district court to craft a new injunction consistent with the PLRA, which is the Prison Litigation Reform Act, and its opinion, meaning the Seventh Circuit's opinion. So they were sent back for more work.
But then on remand, the parties supplemented the record as directed by the court. After reviewing the supplemental documentation, the court held an evidentiary hearing on August 25th of 2025 to further clarify and develop the record. Now, I've heard you think about, talk about future forecasting about the need for a fully developed record.
You've heard me do that for years, then. You haven't. This is an example of why I encourage that the record be fully developed at the trial court level. You don't get bogged down by having to have the case come back and years of delay, and you get a more accurate, timely resolution if you do the record properly up front.
All right. Well, then Jacob Kalal and George Needs are civilly committed to the Big Muddy River Correctional Center Sexually Dangerous Persons Program. That is a mouthful, Larry. Plaintiff Needs. And this guy is literally named Needs, okay? So it sounds like I'm saying he needs, but his name is Needs. So Plaintiff Needs was first committed in 1981. He has been housed at Big Muddy since 1995. Plaintiff Kalal was first committed in 2001 and has been housed at Big Muddy since his commitment.
Did you say that Jacob Kalal has been committed since 1981?
I did. And so that's what, 43 years or 44 years? 45 years even.
And that's based on what he might do.
That's based on what he might do, as in like, we think that you might be... So wait, if he's been there for that long, like, if he was convicted when he was 20, if he was put away when he was 20, he's in his 60s. Like, what's the dude going to do? He's probably 70 or 80 years old.
Well, that'll come up later. But yeah, it is a strange case. And I'm embellishing this just a little bit. These people, it's not for what they might do. We'll explain in a little more detail, but it's because they have been apprehended for a PFR-type offense. And
that's how they got on the radar, and then they evaluate them as being dangerous, and then, your sentence is over.
No, by the way, we're sending you across the street. They do this before. This person has been... This is a group of people that are committed before they're convicted. So it's a different, different track.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, according to the court, an estimated 5,400 individuals... Wow, that's a lot of people, are civilly committed under state and federal sex offender programs across the country. Illinois has enacted two sexual commitment statutes, the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act, which is what we've been talking about, and then the Sexually Violent Persons Act, which is SVPA. Individuals committed under SVPA have been criminally convicted, and their treatment at the Rushville Treatment and Detention Center, which is operated by the Illinois Department of Human Services. Those committed under the SDPA have not been convicted of a PFR-type offense and are held at Big Muddy under the operation of the Illinois Department of Corrections.
Yes, they have a unique system in Illinois for sure. This is the first time I've seen this kind of structure.
But let's go in and examine the SDPA. Tell us how that works.
Well, the SDPA is on the front end. When any person is charged with a criminal offense, and it shall appear to the prosecutor that such a person is a sexually dangerous person within the meaning of this particular act, then the prosecutor may file with the clerk of the court in the same proceeding where the person is charged with that criminal offense a petition setting forth the facts tending to show that the person named is a sexually dangerous person.
Now, this means they might get treatment prior to a conviction?
Theoretically, I think that's what it means, yes.
Can you help us out with some legal terms, and what is the legal definition of an SDP?
According to the Illinois statute, a sexually dangerous person is defined as a person suffering from a mental disorder for at least a year, coupled with criminal propensities to the commission of sex offenses, and who have demonstrated propensities toward acts of sexual assault or acts of sexual molestation of children. And that's under Illinois 725 ILCS 205/1.01. That's a mouthful.
That is also a mouthful. What rights does a person have in SDP proceedings?
The individual has a right to an attorney and a jury trial. If the individual is found beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a good standard, to be an SDP, they are placed in the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections, and the Director of Corrections is required to provide for care and treatment of the committed individual designated to effect recovery. The treatment must conform with the standards promulgated by the Sex Offender Management Board Act and conducted by a treatment provider licensed under the Sex Offender Evaluation and Treatment Provider Act.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there, too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
an SDP may petition the committing court in writing to be released. Now, once an SDP petitions for release, he or she is evaluated by an evaluator licensed under the Illinois Sex Offender Evaluation and Treatment Provider Act. Those recovery evaluations are performed by employees of Wexford Health Sources Incorporated. Now, what is the legal standard to continue holding the person?
Well, to continue the commitment, the state must prove by clear and convincing evidence, which is a good standard, properly placed on the right burden, evidence that the SDP remains a sexually dangerous person. No additional application may be filed for 2 years after a finding that the person is still a sexually dangerous or after the application is withdrawn unless special circumstances are met. So if you file it and get second thoughts, you're screwed. And if you file it and lose, you're screwed for 2 years. And but other than that, on paper, this looks like a pretty good system.
Unless you're one of the ones on the inside, I suppose. If the state does not meet the burden of proof, what happens next?
Well, in that event, the committing court is required to discharge the SDP if after hearing he or she is found to be no longer dangerous. If the court concludes the person appears no longer to be dangerous, but that it's impossible to determine with certainty under conditions of institutional care that the person is fully recovered, it is to enter an order of conditional or supervised release. So meaning that you can see the logic in this. When you're functioning in an institution, you're not making a lot of your own decisions. So
yes,
the fact that
correct.
You can show up for group counseling and the fact that you can behave yourself when you've got something that's going to knock you in the head if you don't, it's hard for us to know for certain or with any certainty that you're going to be able to do that without the supervision and structure. So therefore, the conditional supervised release is an appropriate mechanism because otherwise the judges would just err on the side of holding everybody in custody. So I like that part of it.
Well, on page 5, the judge stated individual therapy is not provided through the SDPP. The program utilizes cognitive behavioral therapy based on the risk needs responsivity model and the Illinois Sex Offender Management Board's guidelines and offers 3 categories of therapy: primary core group therapy, offense-specific group therapy, and didactic, which is psychoeducational group therapy. An SDP may be in a general group, one or more sex offense specific groups, and one or more didactic groups.
Now, come again, what does didactic mean for a person who dropped out of high school?
It's like self-teaching, I guess you could say. Didactic means intended to teach or instruct, often in a moral or educational way. I've always heard the term like an autodidact, which is a person that learns on their own. They study books and exercises, then they learn stuff on their own.
Well, you know, it's always been my position that these treatment programs are not really designed to treat the offender. And the judge noted that, quote, primary therapy groups are process-oriented groups focused on gaining insight into offense-related behaviors and dynamic risk factors. SDPs and primary therapy groups present assignments including life history, case report, offense cycles, and release recovery plans. Primary therapy groups meet once or twice a week for 90 minutes per session. 4 therapists run group therapy while the newest therapists are in orientation. Isn't that sweet?
I noticed that the judge stated, at the time of trial, group therapy sessions were canceled at a rate as high as 38%. Canceled groups were rarely rescheduled. The cancellation of group therapy sessions continued into 2025, with sessions frequently canceled due to low staff availability.
Now, I think we're funny. We're going to be, can you admit that that's funny? Over 1/3 of all sessions were canceled.
And I'm assuming you need those sessions to help build a case, build a docket, so to speak, that you are moving along and you are recovered. And
yes.
If you can't then go get those rescheduled, then you have all that missing baggage and you just get dragged through the mud even longer. So, no, that's not funny, except in the mind of a deranged individual such as you.
I think it's hilarious.
Yeah, that's why you're the deranged individual, Larry.
So, alrighty then.
Well, let's go into the most important aspect of the case. An SDP is supposed to be receiving treatment. Did the trial reveal how much treatment each plaintiff received?
It did. Did you read this case?
Very, very thoroughly.
Yeah. And what were you doing when you read it?
Today was a grass cutting day, so I was out there cutting the grass.
So between May of 2024 and May of 2025, plaintiff Kalal was offered an average of 2.18 hours of primary group therapy per week. And plaintiff Needs was offered an average of 1.95 hours of primary group therapy per week. Sarah Brown Foyles, I guess is how you pronounce that.
Works for me.
She's the Illinois Department of Corrections Manager for Sex Offense Services. She testified in the last 12 months, one of the primary therapists was on maternity leave for 3 months, and the other therapists were not available to cover groups, resulting in cancellations. Brown Foyles was unable to provide information regarding how many of the council sessions were rescheduled. Now imagine that. They wouldn't be able to provide that. That's funny for sure.
Yeah. You mentioned that an SDP can file a petition to be discharged. Do you have any idea how that works?
Yes. When an SDP petitions the court for a recovery evaluation, as it's called, the evaluation is conducted by Wexford Health Sources Incorporated. Evaluators who are under contract with the Illinois Department of Corrections. At the time of trial, the evaluators were Dr. Melissa Weldon Padera and Dr. Christopher Clonch, I think. The purpose of the Wexford evaluation is to analyze the current and future risks the SDP poses and to ultimately make a recommendation for or against discharge or conditional release from the program.
Honestly, that sounds kind of strange. Wexford is not actually providing the treatment, so how do they evaluate the individual? How do they evaluate the person?
Well, the Wexford evaluators base their evaluation and recommendation on the treatment file maintained by the SDPP. Now, remember, this is the treatment that all got canceled at a rate of 38%.
Right.
Including the semi-annual assessments, treatment plans, and case notes created by the primary therapist, and a brief consultation with the SDP's primary therapist, and occasionally an interview with the SDP.
Did you intentionally use the word occasionally just now? So they occasionally interview the SDP?
I did, and that's funny, but I won't even bother asking you to agree.
That's also wise. And thank you for not asking, because it's not really all that funny. So on page 9, the judge stated between 2011 and 2018, 22 SDPs were released, discharged or recommended for release, or discharged by an evaluator. Since October 2018, 45 SDPs have been released, discharged or recommended for release or discharge. Five have been discharged. 31 have been released and remain in the community. 4 have been discharged but violated conditional release and returned to Big Muddy. And 5 have been recommended for release but remain at Big Muddy. Why are those 5 that have been recommended for release still there?
I didn't see it in the case document, but I'm assuming it's because they have not been able to put together a satisfactory conditional release plan that would include stable housing and my computer.
So they are released, but they don't necessarily have an address.
So, yes.
For you?
Yes, I don't have any electricity.
Rutrow, what do you want to do then?
It's coming back up, so all we can do is pause and let the thing reboot.
Okay. Very well. And I'm having storms here, and I thought I was going to run out of power.
All right. We're back in business. All you got to do is do a little chop out there for that brief disruption.
Oh, I thought you would have to, like, the whole computer came back on already? Or just, that doesn't make any sense.
I think we're on backup power.
Oh, okay. That's good. All right. So why have those five, why are those 5 that have been recommended for release still there?
I don't really have any idea, but I'm assuming that it has to do with the fact that they have not been able, most of them, based on the data, are going to get conditional release rather than fully released, and they probably haven't been able to put together a release plan that satisfies the conditions that the court wants to see. So that's probably why they're still sitting there.
Got it. All right. Well, then Dr. Dean R. Cawley testified as an expert. Dr. Cawley received a bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of Michigan, a master's degree in mental health counseling from Oakland University, an MBA from Ludger College of Business, and a PhD in mental health counseling with a focus on criminal justice from Wayne State University. He has been in the private practice sector of things since 2003 and has provided expert opinions and analysis in civil commitment cases in state and federal courts. What did Dr. Cawley opine about treatment at Big Muddy?
Dr. Cawley offered the following opinions at trial. Dr. Cawley said the SDP falls far below the generally accepted standards in the field of civilly committed sex offender treatment with respect to the amount of therapy offered to SDPs and group sizes. The inherent flaws in the SDPP result in treatment that is slow, repetitive, and not catered to the mission of treating the men and returning them to the community as quickly as possible. In reaching his conclusions, Dr. Cawley relied on the generally accepted practices of inpatient sex offender treatment as determined through a network called the Sex Offender Civil Commitment Program Network, or SOCCPN.
Now, I want to circle back to the issue of release and at Wexford's role. Did Dr. Cawley testify about that?
He did, and with respect to Wexford recovery release evaluations, Dr. Cawley offered the following opinions. Quote, tests were presented as having considerable predictive validity when they actually have very little. Can you imagine that?
Yes.
Indicators of risk were underscored as predicting future sexual violence when these items have shown minimal research outcomes as being predictive. Important topics such as age or the passage of time were not given any attention in the evaluations. The Wexford evaluations are based largely on the past acts to assess the current condition of the SDP. Dr. Cawley noted that both sexual recidivism as well as antisocial traits decline beginning at age 40 and rapidly decline after age 60. My, can you imagine how low mine is? It's at the age of 190?
Yours is a negative number.
And the Wexford evaluations do not adhere to a generally accepted practice or evidence-based decision-making. Now, that's coming from someone who has apparently been granted expert classification by the court and seems to have a strong background. He's saying this about the Illinois program.
Well, the one thing that I will challenge there at the end, Larry, is it says evidence-based, and we are not a nation of evidence-based decision-making. That I know for sure. But then, according to the trial judge, the 14th Amendment prohibits the state from depriving any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. In the context of civil commitment, due process requires that the nature and duration of commitment bear some reasonable relation to the purpose for which the individual is committed. And that's citing Kansas versus Hendricks, 521 U.S. 346 through 356 from 1997.
And that's from the United States Supreme Court.
I see.
And the judge went on to say, if the object or purpose of the state law is to provide treatment, but the treatment provisions were adopted as a sham or mere pretext, there would be an indication of the forbidden purpose to punish. You can tell that this judge has been listening to Registry Matters, correct?
Yes, of course.
And then he went on to say, if civil commitment were to become a mechanism for retribution or general deterrence, Supreme Court precedents would not suffice to validate it. And then he referred back to Hendricks, because Hendricks says treatment is required. Thus, the 14th Amendment mandates that civil detainees receive treatment for the disorders that led to their confinement and be released when they have improved enough to no longer be dangerous. Folks, civil commitment is not unconstitutional. Get that through your head. But if you don't treat people with intent, provide them medical treatment with the intent of releasing them, you're violating the Constitution if you're merely warehousing them. You can commit people, but you must try to rehab them and get them out of there.
And then I read several pages of the judge's conclusion of law. Can you reduce those pages down to a concise finding for our audience? And then I'll also request that you dumb it down for, well, me, so that I can understand it.
Well, that was quite a long litany of conclusions. But what he has done, he set this case up to go back up to the Seventh Circuit, and he wants the Seventh Circuit to basically rubber stamp what he's done. So this case, he went into great detail of explaining all what they're doing wrong there. But the court stated, with respect to the claims asserted in counts 1 and 2, the court concludes that the defendants continue to fail in their obligation to provide plaintiffs with statutorily required rehabilitative treatment. Consequently, the SDPP, as currently structured and implemented, fails to meet generally accepted professional standards and violates plaintiffs' right to due process as guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. That's the most important thing the judge said.
Now, for the foregoing reasons, plaintiffs Jacob Kalal and George Needs request for a permanent injunction with respect to the claims asserted in counts 1 and 2. They are granted. That's pretty good news, I think. Is that you right there, Larry?
No, that's the judge. You go ahead.
Okay, so then the judge went on to say, the court simply cannot allow plaintiffs' constitutional rights to continue to be so blatantly disregarded and violated. While the court recognizes that correcting systemic and structural deficiencies to comply with a court-imposed order to provide specific relief to the plaintiffs herein may pose a significant challenge to defendants, the Constitution mandates that they meet the challenge and do so expeditiously. Accordingly, the following permanent injunctive release is ordered. Number one, plaintiffs shall receive a minimum of 5 hours of group therapy per week. And number two, recovery release evaluation shall analyze the current and future risk the SDP poses based on treatment effects rather than solely historical information. Defendants are further ordered to file a status report under seal regarding their compliance with the instant order within 60 days of its entry. Can you explain that, please?
Well, what's going to happen here is going to be very similar to what happened in the Doe versus Snyder case. The state's going to claim they don't have any money. And some of the things I didn't mention is how they cried about staffing shortages. They can't hire anybody. And you remember Illinois is a governed blue state, and they know how to do everything perfectly, and they care about people so much in Illinois, but they can't staff their facilities. So what's going to happen is that they're going to cry the blues, saying that they don't have the wherewithal to provide 5 hours of treatment. And the judge is going to be in a real conundrum, because this judge is going to be faced with making a decision, like the judge in Doe versus Snyder finally had to do it. There was a date certain that the registry was going to go dark because he allowed a period of time for the legislators to legislate. Remember that?
Sure. Yeah.
And people said he ordered them. I said, no, he didn't order. He allowed them time. I said, they have no reason to legislate because nothing is not bothering them. The status quo is just fine. So when a date certain that the registry was going to go dark was announced, magically they legislated. That's exactly what's going to happen here. There's a lot of things that need funding in Illinois, and every state government needs to fund. And locking up PFRs is not anything you can go out and campaign. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You send me to the state capitol. I will make sure that we get as much treatment in there for them sex offenders as we can get. And we're going to take that money out of the college and university system of the state. We're going to take it out of the K-12 education. We're going to take it out of whatever. And we're going to take care of these sex offenders. That's not a good platform to run on. So therefore, they're going to do absolutely nothing. When the status order comes in 60 days, the status report comes in, it's going to be filled with reasons why they can't do anything and the struggles they're up against. And the judge is going to be boxed into a corner. Is he going to give them a date certain to let people out if they don't meet these, or is the status quo going to be continued? It's going to be quite interesting.
Wouldn't it... forgive me for being kind of Pollyanna about this. If they were to prioritize who has had the most treatment, the most likely to succeed, they could whittle the number of people in civil commitment down to the point where they could have the 5 hours of group therapy per week.
You're absolutely correct.
And they could.
and that's the way that I would do it if I were them. We played that game here in Bernalillo County a couple of decades ago with jail overcrowding. And I was so minimally involved in this, only just talking to a team on the legal team. But what you have to do to force their hands is the judge has to be willing, since this is a federal judge appointed by life, the judge will have to say, well, I'll tell you what, if y'all can't come up with a way to get your population down, then I'm going to create a matrix. And you would start with people that have been in there 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And you would use the most reliable data that we have, that age is a big predictor of future offending. And you'd set a matrix and you would just start releasing people on the order of the court. Now, the state might not object to that because they might figure, well, if the judge does it, then we can point our finger at the lifetime liberal Obama appointed judge that did this. And we won't have to raise any taxes or reallocate any funds. But that's what it's going to take to get anything to change. The judge is going to have to start releasing people. I'll be shocked if they actually appropriate money and start doing anything proactive themselves.
Right. And just from my very limited experience and exposure, like, this doesn't even happen, though. Like, it's not like they're going to let the time expire and just open up the front door and let people out.
Nope, not going to happen.
Yeah.
So
lovely. So does this then mean this was just a waste of time?
No. It's eventually, if it's a judge that means business, eventually people will start getting released, but it's not going to be quick.
Right. So, shall we refer back to Mr. Doom and Gloom?
Yeah, but I do have a funny when you get ready for it.
That's fine. We can go over a funny.
Okay. So I was trying to do the prep on the Mac this week because the old PC is getting really slow and I need some help to get it sped up again. And the Mac, as you know, operates slightly different. And I was going to...
Slightly?
I was going to... last week, I didn't save the Word document when I dropped it into the Google Doc. I figured I would just... If I wanted a Word document, I would just copy it all and make a Word document for the permanent archive later. Well, when I opened a new episode 374, I was confused which one I was working on, and I deleted everything that was in there from 373.
Yep.
And therefore, 373 is empty, and I don't have a Word document. So if we ever wanted to create that script, we would have to do it from the transcript.
I understand. I like how you said the Mac is slightly different. That's funny.
Well, it is slightly different.
Slightly is being very generous.
Well, I'm going to have you remote in next week and see if we can speed this ancient PC up, because otherwise I need to get a new one.
We can see what we can do. Well, head over to registrymatters.co and you can find show notes and links to everything that you need to find, links to get to Patreon, which will come up here in just a moment, links over to the transcripts and to FYP education. You can send email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And you can certainly leave an old-fashioned voicemail message that I will send promptly over to Larry because he loves the telephone, 747-227-4477. And of course, please support us on Patreon at patreon.com/registrymatters. And that's all I got, sir. Oh, also make sure you go buy merch over at fypeducation.com/shop. That's all I got.
Well, I look forward to seeing you in another episode.
Very well. Have a great night, Larry, and I will talk to you soon.
7 a.m.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.